Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver, and this is the What's in Your Colon show. But before we start,
I'm not going to answer that question.
Well, you don't know.
It's supposed to make you think.
You don't know yet. But I've got to say, I am in the Radio Health Evangelist Protection Program. You may notice my voice is blurry. You can't tell which side of the room I'm coming from because I made a mistake last week, a whopper. I make lots of mistakes in this show, but last week
none
I made
as noticeable as this one.
This one was pretty bad. Well, I said that measles causes shingles. And that
it meant
was
to be chicken pox.
And I got to tell you, Rick, so I'm listening to the show with my wife. And by the way, that's a mistake right there, if you want to talk about
for
it.
For her.
Yeah, well, for both of us. But at any rate, she looks at me. When this came out, she said, "What did you just say?" And I realized I had said that measles causes chicken shingles.
I was scared to correct you on air because I'm not the smart one here.
Well, and then the next day, this is when I knew it had gotten to epic proportions here. Pat Greenfield, who's a very nice woman, she is a saint. I saw her in church, and she says, "I wanted to ask you, does measles?" And I said, "Shut up." You know. And I realized, well, I've got to fix things. You just don't say that to a person like Pat. She's too nice.
You mean you don't say shut up?
That's right.
You should also tell them what actually gives you shingles and not
Oh, that's our sponsor. First, we would like to thank our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and I'd like to introduce our guest today. First of all, from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, Manager of Clinical Nutrition Services, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And Jean has brought with her from Eastern Kentucky University dietetic intern Kelly Jewell. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
With us, as always, to explain why in the world we're on the Internet, from the University of Kentucky, service owner for telephony, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. Well, I can't really answer why we're on the Internet. I think it's somebody's grace that allows us to be there, but I'm not sure whose. But if you decide you want to call on that grace and go to WMKY.org, you can listen to previous shows. Go find out where Tony makes a mistake. It's in the previous show on the site. You just have to go look. It's like number 2 on the site. Right, Tony?
Sure.
Can I keep rubbing this in?
Sure.
Because, you know, I never make mistakes.
You never correct mistakes.
Anyway, you can listen to the audio of the shows there at WMKY.org. You can go to iTunes and get a podcast. There's a link there. Have Health Matters delivered to your device automagically. I love that term, automagically.
I know.
And anyway.
Did you coin that one?
No. It's something they use in the IT business.
Oh.
Sometimes we're hoping for automatic, but what we get is automagic. You know? So anyway, audio of the shows, WMKY.org. To read about the show, to feed us some information, to make a comment, go to Facebook.com/HMRadioShow, and you'll find a page there on Facebook devoted to Health Matters. We post up there occasionally about show topics and interesting health news or health research that comes across our desks. If you do a search on Health Matters Radio Show on Facebook, you should find that page. Again, just go to Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
And along those lines, I'd like to just mention to Bill in California, we are aware of the audio issue with a couple of shows, and I apologize, I haven't gotten back to you on that. Our sponsor for today's show, the Error Prevention Agency, the EPA. You can be the solution to Health Matters confusion. Only you can stop the errors. Again, the error last week was in saying that measles would resurface as shingles. Obviously, that is not true. Well, it was an hour. You were confusing me like you always do.
I wanted to correct you, but I was scared.
Fun fact, these are similarities and differences between measles and chickenpox. So I've got
they both itch.
Yeah. Well, they both do. Actually, it's kind of interesting. You know where the word chickenpox came from?
Well, it's two words, technically.
Well, chicken. Where did the chicken and chickenpox come from?
I would assume it came from eggs. I don't know.
That's no help at all. Actually, there are several theories. Nobody knows why they call it chickenpox. Perhaps it's less dangerous than smallpox, so it's a chicken version of smallpox.
That's a stretch.
That's not a stretch. Good. That's
well,
not
what
good.
About the specks you get on your skin, the rash you get on your skin, looks like it was pecked by a chicken?
That's a stretch.
Okay, so Kelly and Jean, I've got two dietitians here. The disease was named after chickpeas or garbanzo beans because it's similar to the seeds of those beans, the spots you get on your skin.
I don't believe that.
That's not appetizing.
Okay. So good. Well, if you like garbanzo beans, since I don't like garbanzo beans, I have no problems at all relating anything to garbanzo beans or chickpeas.
You don't like hummus?
No. No, absolutely.
Tony.
Let's all raise our hands. Look at the radio audience right now. Do you see that sea of people not raising their hands because they don't like hummus? Come on. Who likes hummus?
I like it.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Why did you invite these people?
I don't know. It's a rough thing. Then the final possibility is it's a corruption of the old English word gitchen, which means itching. So maybe
there
it is
go.
A gitchen pox or an itching pox, and they just named it chicken
so
pox.
So you were wrong twice.
That's about as good as you can get.
You were wrong when you corrected yourself.
Well, by the way, as far as measles, the origin of measles, this was not even a fun fact. We've already spent time on it. It's Middle English measles, plural of measle, which is a spot. And by the way, measly comes from the root of measles.
Technically, aren't there a bunch of spots?
There are a bunch of spots in measles, yes.
Why they call smallpox smallpox?
Yeah, good question.
Because that's a pretty big thing to get.
Yeah,
right?
None of the. Yeah,
it only hits small people.
Oh.
No, it doesn't.
You wish. But by the same token, yeah, I don't think any of the poxes make any sense. I think they're too old to understand. But perhaps it's an itchy pox and they just call it chicken pox because the word for itchy sounds like chicken. Since we're moving along here very rapidly, I'm going to give you three fun facts, differences, and similarities.
Hey, look, my hat's off to you that there's not 10 of the things.
Oh, there are 10. Chicken pox is called varicella. That is the official name of it. Measles is called rubeola. Fact number two, chicken pox caused by a herpes virus, measles by a paramyxovirus. And number three, both chicken pox and measles are highly infectious. Both are transmitted by airborne route. Basically, small droplets get into the air, you breathe them in. And 75 to 90% of people who are exposed and aren't vaccinated will get the disease. That is, if there's one person in your house, in your daycare center, in your vicinity who has measles or chickenpox and you are not vaccinated, you will, in fact, get the disease. And number four, I'll give you this. Before vaccination, 90% of people had both chickenpox and measles before age 15.
You
believe
did.
I am one of those people.
Me
yes.
too.
Okay. Jean?
Did not have measles. Had chickenpox because my mother intentionally exposed me, saw what I had before I went to school.
Yep.
Yeah,
that was.
And,
may, since my daughters listen occasionally, I may or may have not done that.
But,
we will
but
never tell
be,
whether that actually happened in our house.
But I had to be vaccinated for the measles.
Okay. And Kelly, I'm assuming you being a civilized human being, actually, this is all appalling to you that people will be exposed to these diseases.
And her youth would suggest that she hasn't had either.
You have not had measles or chickenpox?
I have had chickenpox.
Oh.
Yes.
Really?
I was also intentionally exposed. It was a tough love sort of situation where they threw us to the wolves and for a better good.
Oh, okay. So we've got two chickenpox measles and one
just chicken.
Chicken.
One just
okay.
chicken.
All right. So that's our sponsor, the Error Prevention Agency.
Was everything you said in that correct?
Yes, I read it.
Just making sure.
Yeah, I put that on paper. That's why I do this. You can be the solution to health matters confusion. Only you can correct errors. Please let us know. And my apologies to Pat Greenfield.
You know what the greatest thing about this is? We get to do this two more times this show.
That's absolutely right. I am doing this. I am making sure that this does not happen again.
And I'm
this came
sure
from the August 23rd. It was actually published in the journal Frontiers in Neurology from Loyola University. There was a 60-year-old woman who was in reasonably good health. And as she was trying to fall asleep one evening, she began hearing music as if there were a radio playing in the back of her head. They were popular tunes. Her husband recognized them, but she herself could not even identify the tunes. This is called musical hallucinations. First known case of a patient who hallucinated music that was familiar to people around her, but she herself did not recognize, or so say the neurologists at Loyola University. Now, musical hallucinations are a form of auditory hallucination. Some people hear voices talking to them, but in this case, they hear music. There's no such music actually playing. That would obviously make sense. Most people realize they're hallucinating. They find the music intrusive and occasionally unpleasant. There is no cure to musical hallucinations. Now, I find this stuff fascinating, so I went to Jean, and Jean is a well-known scoffer. When I bring her something, Jean says, "That's nothing." And Jean made a statement. Jean, replay your reaction when I said musical hallucinations.
Well, I think I said something like, "What's her problem? Doesn't everybody hear music in their head?" I hear music in my head every single day. I have a soundtrack every day.
So the question is, what's the difference between a musical hallucination and getting a song stuck in your head? And to be honest with you, Rick, I went through actually a literature review of the last 10 years of literature on musical hallucinations, and I guess I'm stupid. I cannot answer that question. It appears that they are, in fact, one and the same. The music needs to be not your voice, but some other version, some other voice doing the music. There are all sorts of different tunes that it can be. And again, for the most part, you find it unpleasant. But you are aware that there's not a radio, that there's not a rock band right behind you, and you know that it's not there. And that sounds exactly like getting a song stuck in your head.
Okay, the difference is that I usually can't identify it when I hear it, right?
Well, and most
people
can't
identify it?
She couldn't, which makes her special. But what they're thinking is she just accessed songs that were deep in her memory
to generate these hallucinations.
Now, you ask yourself, well, where do old songs go?
Well, no, I mean, let's be honest. How old is she?
She's 60.
So it's entirely possible that this song popped out of a Lawrence Welk show she saw, and I wouldn't know what the name of those songs
right.
are.
But there were a variety of songs
that she heard.
Did you ever
watch Lawrence Welk when you were young?
I did.
Thank you.
I'm the only one here who ever did.
No, yeah, it is. Well, it was probably the only thing on at that time of day. I mean, that's the only reason I would watch Lawrence Welk. It was not funny.
My mother loved it. It was a command performance. You had to watch Lawrence Welk.
Yeah, and see, that's
I come from the family where it was Hee-Haw.
See, now, okay.
Well, we watched that too, trust me.
There's a whole difference in our families there, Jeanine.
No. I can sing you Gloom, Despair, and Agony on Me without a, you know, hitch.
But Gene, I have some music in my head, but I think, Gene, more than anybody else, you pretty much every day there will be some song stuck in your
every
head.
Every day there's a song, and sometimes I can tell you that, you know, I know I've heard it somewhere. I may not be able to tell you where, but something triggered it. And then sometimes it just, there it is, it pops there. And it can be anything from, you know, like I said, today's was Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Breaks.
When is it Tony Orlando and Dawn?
No, it's never going to be that. Now, on those days, I'm aggravated by it, okay? But, you know, sometimes it's Patsy Cline, and then sometimes it's Frank Sinatra.
This is music that you would like if it would stop at a reasonable time.
Well, sometimes I'm getting into it. I like it. You know, it's okay. It's there. I see it myself.
Musical hallucinations, according to the literature, usually occur in older people.
Thank you for that.
I was going to say, that used to happen to me, but I grew out of it.
Cerebral conditions are possible causes, including hearing impairment, brain damage, epilepsy, intoxication, psychiatric disorders, depression, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorder, not that we've ever seen that, hearing impairment, most common predisposing condition, not itself sufficient to cause hallucinations. And she initially hallucinated music when trying to fall asleep. Within 4 months, she heard it all the time, one song over and over for 3 weeks, and then another song.
That's bad. She did need some variety. I would have complained, too.
You would think, well, the question they didn't ask is, well, what if she, you know, put on music and then, tried to prime the thing? I think the thing was, this song apparently came, she could not decide what the soundtrack was for the day. Now, you can't either. Can you change it?
No. If it's there, it's just there. I don't decide what it's going to be. But I guess she can't tune it out, though. It's like she's trying to have a conversation, and it's so loud that she can't.
No, the volume never changed, but she was able to hear and follow conversations while hallucinating the music. So she, it sounds to me, is very much like
you, Jane. So what's the problem?
Yeah. They treated her with an anti-seizure drug, and she got some improvement, and that's where they left this case. But the thing is, Jean, I suppose you could seek treatment for your music problem, your musical hallucinations.
Well, you know, it's all the way you look at it. Because, I don't look at it as a problem. I like music.
And you don't have to carry earphones and radio around with you.
Well,
you can just generate
portable.
Your own station.
I'm going to get this disclaimer out ahead of time. You're about to go on a break, and you are not hallucinating. You probably will hear some music.
Stay tuned for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is a second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the What's in Your Colon show.
Actually, it should be What's in Your Brain. Did you hear music while we were
I was jamming down to Led Zeppelin.
So, that's the
I heard banjos.
Yeah, with us, our Led Zeppelin channeler, which turned out to be a very difficult thing to say, registered dietitian, manager of clinical nutrition services at St. Clair Regional Medical Center, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And also with her from Eastern Kentucky University dietetic intern, Kelly Jewell. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
Our sponsor for the second time, Error Prevention Agency, be the solution to Health Matters confusion. Only you can stop the errors. I will remind you again, and Rick is enjoying this. I, last week, mistakenly said that measles comes back as shingles. That is incorrect. Chickenpox comes back as shingles. And so to punish myself, which this is my weird mental thing that I do, I actually have listed the top 10 similarities and differences between chickenpox and measles. We talked about naming and we talked about infectiousness last time.
No, let's talk more about how you made the mistake.
Before vaccination, 90% of people have both chickenpox and measles. That was similarity number four. Number five. Before measles vaccine became available in 1967, there were over 500 deaths a year due to measles. Before chickenpox vaccine was developed in 1995, there were over 100 deaths per year due to chickenpox. These vaccines almost eliminate those deaths. Fact number six, chickenpox vaccine is 2 doses 3 months or more apart, usually starting at 12 months. If you did not have chickenpox as a child and you are an adult, if you're thinking about getting pregnant, working with young people, or working in healthcare, you probably should get a chickenpox vaccine. Measles vaccine, 2 doses 1 month or more apart, starting at age 12 months. And again, measles, very rare for a person not to either have measles or now to have the measles vaccine. And everyone needs to get the vaccine for measles. Fun fact number seven, chickenpox, a rash of small, itchy blisters with pus inside them. They crust over in 6 days, and they're cleared within 1 to 2 weeks. Measles, red spots, flow together into patches, beginning on the face, spreading throughout the body, lasts about a week, and then the rash flakes off. We will finish up our 10 fun facts in our third and final fractional portion. That's our sponsor, the Error Prevention Agency. Be the solution to health matters confusion.
Unfortunately, you probably won't be wrong about that. We probably will have a full 10.
Probably so. Now, back to our...
Music in the head?
No.
We've talked enough about
that. Yeah, we're through with that. We just let Jean just sing along to herself, and we're fine. This was a viewpoint. It was in the American Medical Association Journal, August 21st. The title was A Call for an End to the Diet Debates. From Rush University and University of Massachusetts, two authors for this, they said, look, as the obesity epidemic persists, the time has come to end the pursuit of the ideal diet for weight loss and disease prevention. There have been numerous randomized trials looking at low carbohydrate, low fat, Mediterranean diets, diets with all sorts of different compositions. And when you take those diets out a year or 5 years, the weight losses are very consistent, almost identical. There is not an advantage to limiting one nutrient or another. The metabolic parameters seem to be the same. They said here, four analysis of many trials, 13 to 24 trials, the only consistent finding is that adherence, the degree to which participants continued in the program or met the program goals, was most strongly associated with weight loss and improvement in disease-related outcomes. The most important question then becomes how to develop a diet you can adhere to, not what's in the diet. They go further to say that this idea of the content of the diet ignoring adherence has spawned a multi-billion dollar industry of a bunch of different competing diets, which all claim to be a better diet overall without really addressing how do we get people to follow their diet.
You know, however people can do it, they've got to eat less, because if you gain a lot of weight, you've obviously been eating more than you should, okay? So portions are a really important thing. Now, obviously, I would like people to eat very well-balanced diets and plenty of veggies, but we'll not go there right now.
Of course you would say that.
Of course I would say that. I had to throw that out, but we'll not go there right now. But, you know, when you look at studies and records of people who have managed to keep weight off for a long period of time, one of the things that you see is accountability to themselves, not to someone else, you know, and they've got some method, whether it's record-keeping or whatever, of keeping an account of what they eat and how much they exercise. So accountability is a big part of it. And then there is that exercise factor. You know, if you don't have some type of physical activity, you will gain it back. And it doesn't have to be anything horribly expensive or strenuous, but you've got to do something regularly.
Now, Jean, of course, has become jaded as the years have passed and her diets, as she's seen patient after patient fall off the wagon from a dietary standpoint. Kelly, you're still bright-eyed, youthful. You've got some experience in the real world now working here at St. Clair. What are you seeing that seems to be a big problem with people maintaining their diets?
You know, I think a lot, actually, of what I see comes from the support that the person has.
And that was the next thing. They always have to have support. That's one of the factors. So.
Yeah, I see a lot of patients who, when I'm talking with them, they seem interested. They like, you know, they don't like the whole diet, but they see one part of it that they could change, that they could begin to incorporate into their life. But you see their family members coming in with bags of McDonald's, or you see their kids saying, well, I do the grocery shopping and I don't know that that's going to work, or, you know, something. So it's...
Or their husband saying, well, I'm not going to eat that. You know, you'll have to, like, fix my fried chicken and French fries or whatever it is that he eats, you know. No, I hear that a lot.
Right. So I think it's really establishing some way that that person can find a family member, a friend, a group that they get involved with that's going to support them, or finding a reason that's going to be important enough for themselves. Well, it's not important to their husband, but maybe it's important for themselves, for their grandchildren, or something that you can give them to motivate, because otherwise, if the support's not there.
And I think that the motivation has to be, it can't be looks, you know, cosmetic purposes. I think it's got to be because they want to be healthier, because they want to live to see their grandkids grow up, that kind of thing.
That brings me to my first question then. What about the person who tries to lose weight, say, for a wedding or for a special event? How has that worked out?
Oh, it's very possible. Yeah. And then when the wedding's over,
there it comes.
It's irrelevant. The person gets the goal they wanted, and then they've built no foundation for themselves and things that are realistic. And so it all comes right back.
And then some.
Yeah. So I think the take home from this, and I absolutely agree with these editorialists, is it's time to stop looking, searching for the perfect diet. It is going to be different for everyone. Mm-hmm. It is the diet that you can follow for a long time.
Well, we've talked about that before, right?
Only about 100 times.
Yeah, like, the same thing doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't.
Right. So you've got to find that diet, and I think the idea of having support, well, may revisit that later on the show. I've got another article that sort of hits on that, and I like that direction. Something from Sidney Wolfe, published in the British Medical Journal August 22nd, was talking about the FDA and the European Medicines Agency. It's called EMA. That's the FDA equivalent for the European countries and their healthcare systems. Now, the FDA has approved in the past year two drugs. One is lorcaserin. It's marketed as Belviq, and it is very similar to some of the drugs that have been banned in the U.S. Previously, but supposedly it might be a little bit safer. Gene, you're not supposed to laugh when I'm reading the article, okay? But, yeah, it's supposed to be a little bit safer. The
Just
weight loss
bit.
Around 3% with Belviq. And then there's something called Qsymia. Qsymia is a combination of two drugs, and there are significant adverse events with it, but again, a small percentage of weight loss with Qsymia. Now, the FDA approved Qsymia, but said, yeah, there's some real problems with heart attack and stroke, so we probably ought to monitor that. The European Medicines Agency rejected both drugs, rejected Qsymia the second time in February 2013, showing that they have concern about the medicine's long-term effect on heart and blood vessels, as were with the other drugs. And so really the question becomes, why are these drugs approved in the U.S. but banned in the European countries? United Kingdom endocrinologist Gareth Williams said, the fate of sibutramine, that's Meridia, that's the old diet drug that's been banned, reminds us how little anti-obesity drugs have to offer, at best a reduction of a few percent in total burden of excess weight carried until death. He said, but with our energy homeostasis, that is, with our ability to conserve energy so deeply enmeshed in our physiology, it seems very unlikely that a magic bullet could ever turn off the switch for food intake without doing something else really detrimental. So essentially what Wolf is saying, and the British endocrinologist is saying, is we're not going to find the drug. We've already established we're not going to find the diet that works. We're also not going to find the drug that works.
Well, you know, we just need a good famine, don't we? I mean, that's what the metabolic thing's all about anyway, is to save us from dying during famines. Now, see, so what are we complaining about,
okay,
right? I don't want to go through a famine.
Well, but I think it's unfortunate that we keep looking for that thing, that apparently we are set, the way we're going to live is the way we're going to live, and now we're going to bring something, a patch, into our current lifestyle that allows us to continue our current lifestyle, but either use a medication or do some type of dietary trick
calories. The Europeans usually approve things long before we do. So what does it tell you when they're saying, oh, no, we're not approving this? Nuh-uh. Well, that speaks to me. If the Europeans want to approve it, I don't want to take it. And so if we're approving it, why are we approving it? What are your thoughts on that? I have a thought on that, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, looking at the deliberations of the FDA before they approved it, they recognized that we have such a problem with obesity that they were willing to try some, I would say, desperate solutions. These drugs are not. They're not at the level of safety of most of the medicines. They're not at the level of effectiveness of most of the medicines that I would prescribe in my practice. And I will tell you, I don't prescribe them.
No.
I simply don't, because I don't think they're safe,
not.
And I don't think they're effective.
No, and you know, what lengths are you willing to go to, and what damage to your body are you willing to risk? You know, you want to risk your heart valves? Uh-uh.
But do you really think that the average human thinks about their heart valves? I mean, come on.
No, they probably don't even know they have them.
Put this on the website. That may be one of the most profound questions, Rick, I have ever heard. Does the average human think about their heart valves? And the answer is obviously no, but I like the way you ask it.
Why would
that really
we put
a good question.
A medical spin on this question? We can't. this thing has to be addressed at the family level. It has to be addressed at a societal level. It has to be way, I mean, we have to figure out how to get back and do physical labor or exercise. One of the two. We have become a society that is automated and everything is easy to do, or at least that's what we strive to get to, is to something easier. So our bodies are doing less and less.
We're evolving.
Yeah, well, not in the right direction.
No, I'm just saying.
I mean, isn't this the first generation that's probably not going to live as long as their parents? Aren't we in that? Aren't we getting to that?
Yeah, we're living less.
Yeah. So clearly, we would have to at least submit that all the clinical reasons that we put forth to the general public will never work because they're clinical. They're clinically thought through. They're not. There's something. You got to figure out how to get me to exercise. It's a combination of eating right and exercising. We've done away with one and went to the other extreme on the other.
No, I think that, you know, where we went wrong is where we had to quit working for our food. You know, we used to have to, like, work to make, you know, to grow things and preserve it and things like that. And now we used to have to go out and hunt.
No, see, I as a technology guy, I think it's when the TVs became, when we started having two TVs in our home.
Yeah, one in every room.
That's when things started going the wrong way. When we had just one, we still, you know, it was different times.
Kelly,
but now they're everywhere.
You get a chance to look at this from a much more youthful perspective. When you were growing up, by the way, Kelly is in excellent physical shape. She is not obese by anybody's definition. So when you were growing up, what was the TV situation in your house?
We were an active household. I mean, I have a brother and a sister, and we all played sports, and we all had multiple activities. So we had a TV, and we had a Nintendo 64, and we had our technology for the time, but it wasn't something that our day centered around. And I think even for me, in the 8 years since I lived at home, and now I'm nannying or watching my friends' kids who have babies, their activities do center around technology. They do center around video game or an iPad or an iPhone. And I think that's a problem. And I think it wasn't even just 8 years ago when I was at home where it was a problem for me. And it wasn't a problem, I don't think, at the time for a lot of my friends and their families. But it's become how we raise our children, how we entertain our children. And I also think that has to do with how busy families and parents are now. It's a societal thing where we're all so busy, where mom and dad have a lot of stuff to get done. So it's easier maybe to sit their kids down with an iPad to watch something instead of watching them go play in the yard or take them to the park or involve them in some sort of activity.
We've tried to treat obesity as a disease and looking for ways to basically to, I think, to try to find some way to slow down the rise in obesity. And there have been some advantages to treating it as a disease. However, disadvantages as well.
It's a societal and a lifestyle problem more than anything, I think.
This is also an editorial I believe this was in the British Medical Journal, from David Katz, who's an internal medicine preventative specialist at Yale, and he is the director of their prevention research center. And the title is Drugs for Drowning, which really caught my attention. And he said, I've never thought much of drugs for weight loss because I never thought of weight gain as a disease. I think it's more like drowning. Drowning is not a failure of the human body. Human body was adapted to live on dry land. It is not a disease. We don't try to treat drowning with medicines. What we do is we try to prevent people from getting in drowning situations. So we have lifeguards, we have fences, we have signs. We use life vests when we're in the water. We teach people how to swim. The problem is when we look at obesity as a disease, as if we looked at drowning as a disease, and we're trying to figure out how to rescue people after they have taken in water, after they have become obese. He said there is not a single enzyme, a single gene that accounts for the capacity to breathe air, nor is there a single gene or enzyme that makes us fat. It is our bodies are built to store food as energy, as fat. So he said, imagine that while waiting for drugs to fix drowning, we didn't bother to learn how to swim, and we sent our lifeguards home. The more we focus on fixing what isn't broken, the less attention we're apt to direct at what is. He says, once in the realm of relatively desperate choices, options can be a long way from perfect and still be better than no options at all. I support drugs and surgery as choices that should be available, but we can and should, as a society, choose to help far fewer people ever need those options in the first place. We need to direct our solutions there. And it's interesting, then across from both these two articles, both published in British publications, but written by American authors, both these things are really looking at the same thing. It's really time for us to look at this as a problem of the way our society is set up. and try to correct it from that side rather than continuing to search for the new diet, the new drug, or the new surgery that's going to fix everything.
Or even to some extent the new exercise phenomenon, you know, whether it's Zumba or this. I mean, those are fads too. I mean, they come and go. There's name, you know, who's still doing the Richard Simmons stuff?
Oh, that's sad. Do you know who Richard Simmons is, Kelly?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Did you ever watch Richard Simmons?
I did not.
I was a Jack LaLanne guy. I was a Jack LaLanne guy.
I'm just saying, there have been, I remember 2 or 3 years ago, the big end thing was P90X.
Yes.
How much do you hear about that now? I'm just saying, those exercise plans come and go just like diets.
Just like the diets. Yeah, you're right. I think that instead of like those exercise fads, just like with the diets, I think it needs to be just everyday physical activity.
Right. I mean, I have a gentleman who works for me. He's close to 70, and he makes sure he wears a pedometer, and he makes sure he walks 10,000 paces a day.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, he's in much better physical condition than I am. He has a strategy, and it integrates in his daily life. I mean, it's not some weird plan. He just tries to walk a lot.
And like, you know, gardening, different activities like that, that you get physical activity, but you're occupied. You're doing something.
Wrapping up this segment, then, we have concluded as a group that
There is no.
Well, there is not a medical cure for obesity. That quite simply, if you can cure obesity, it would be like curing breathing in water. Your bodies are simply made to store food as fat, and we have to find a way then to not put so much calories in front of ourselves. And we're going to have to change society. That's the message that's coming pretty strongly across the literature, and I sense a little bit of a turning in our attitudes toward obesity, and certainly no one is enthusiastic about the new medications. That is not going to fix society, nor, frankly, is widespread surgery. Yes, have it available. No, do not rely on this as a solution to our problems. We're going to talk more about our problems, and one of them is the fact we've run out of time. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the What's in Your Colon show.
I am so glad we have not yet had to answer that question.
I'm hoping we'll get to it. You never know.
Corn.
Oh, I could have done without that. Bazinga.
Why, Gene? Why? We had
this is always
really
the thing that comes to my mind.
Led Zeppelin and corn.
At that point. That does it. Kelly, you're invited back. Gene. From Eastern Kentucky University, dietetic intern Kelly Jewell. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
And I guess I have to introduce the manager of clinical nutrition services at St. Clair Regional, Gene Jones. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Tony.
Corn remark. Our sponsor for the last time, the Error Prevention Agency, the solution to health matters confusion. Only you can stop the errors. I will remind you for the last time, I did say last time, that last show, that measles might come back as the shingles. That is wrong. Chickenpox comes back as the shingles. Measles, in fact, does not come back for the most part. The final three similarities or differences between measles and chickenpox. Measles can spread 5 days before a person gets a rash. That is, even if you don't have the measles rash, you are contagious up from 5 days before the rash until about 4 days after the rash is gone completely. Chickenpox is considered contagious from 2 days before the rash until the rash scabs over but doesn't have to clear completely. Fact number 9, chickenpox can infect the brain and cause inflammation. That's a 10% mortality with that. Measles also infects the brain 4 times as likely and a 15% mortality rate if measles infects your brain. And this is the sad part. If you remember the circumstances, Rick, we were talking about last week, a church in Texas had some members who were not vaccinated. Measles got into the church, into their daycare center at the church, and there were several people infected. There were no deaths from that, but unfortunately, measles is a deadly disease, and the idea that you could just simply decide not to be vaccinated against a highly contagious deadly disease just baffles me completely. And fun fact number 10, this is a big surprise. After infection, chickenpox remains in the nerve roots of the spinal cord. From there, it can occur on one patch of the skin that is called shingles. After a measles infection, antibodies are developed and reinfection is very rare. Wish I had remembered that last week. That is the major difference between chickenpox and measles. That's our sponsor.
See, I remember when you said that wrong, and I was going to correct you, but I thought, no, that's bad form, so I didn't.
No, I had half a dozen people the next day, and I realized, like I said, when I snapped at Pat, I said, okay, it's time to actually to correct this on air, and my apologies to all who were misled by my inaccurate statement. Next up, this was, I saw this in just one of the newspapers, might have been Time Magazine as I think about it, how to avoid the freshman 15, that infamous weight game when one starts off to college. And they mentioned Maryland's Frostburg State University. They have something called the Be Well Dorm. That's small B with a large W right after it, Well Dorm, where 70 freshmen have an interest in wellness and fitness. They have health-oriented programs, but they also do the P90X that Rick says is out of fashion, insanity workouts together, learn how to cook healthy meals, and make substance-free pledge to prevent each other from going on midnight fast food runs and other substances. There's no requirement to come here other than deciding you want to be a healthier person. But although we're our own individual plan, we all look out for each other. Someone right next door is interested in getting better at healthy eating while another person is wanting to become more physically active.
So we have the food police?
Well, what we have is a group of people who band together to support each other, the very thing that you and Kelly were talking about in terms of sticking with a diet in college. Now, Kelly, you somehow managed to make it through 4 years of college at the University of Kentucky, and you said you were playing intramural sports and apparently did not gain 15 to 20 pounds your freshman year.
I did not.
Okay. And can you give us, from your perspective, and Jean certainly is going to chime in, as she always does, if there are any additional thoughts, when kids are just now starting school, what types of things should they focus on in order to avoid weight gain?
You know, I think there's a few different things you can focus on. I think one is getting involved in your university, whether that's taking a class in the kinesiology department where you can do aerobics or cardio or weightlifting, or it's playing an intramural sport. Or if it's not that, then at least finding a group of friends who don't want to sit in their dorm every night and they want to get out, they want to walk around campus, they want to walk downtown, wherever you can go just to get out and move around. And I think the other thing is knowing where on campus you can get food in between your classes that's not going to be Chick-fil-A, that's not going to be the spicy burrito flip at Ovid's Library Cafe that's 1,000 calories. You know, it's finding somewhere, you know, if it's Tuesdays, you only have 45 minutes in between your classes and you need to get lunch, you need to plan ahead of time to think, okay, where can I go in that 45 minutes to find somewhere that's going to have a vegetable as a side and not only offer me fries and fried chicken.
So I'm picking up three themes, one of which I'm just going to add because I... It's my show. Okay, I can do that. One is the support, and you were talking extensively about that. The first thing, and it's really tough as a freshman if you do not have friends, to try to meet that type of friend very quickly. But you've got to find friends who are interested in healthy living and who are interested in maintaining a diet or a physical activity. Those are the kind that are going to help prevent this. Second thing that you mentioned, obviously, was planning. Whether it is preparing your own food or finding those healthy choices, you cannot allow food to be dictated by the amount of time you have or your geographic location. You have to maintain that independent oversight of the food that goes in. I'll add another one because I know for a lot of people, when you are lonely, and many people are as freshmen, when you are disappointed with your test scores, when you are disturbed with a relationship not working out or whatever, you turn to food for comfort and solace. And I think in the freshman year, especially the fall freshman year, one way to handle loneliness is to eat your way out of it. And so you have to be very careful with using food as a reward. That's just that's a sad commentary on my life.
That must be because, I'm not going to go there.
Thank you very much for not piling on. But I know you see people who use food as kind of as joy.
I do.
It is fun. And let's turn that around. People would go out for pizza because that's a fun evening. Or they would have nachos and sit down and watch a ball game or something like that. That's a fun night at the dorm. And certainly there's enough popcorn around dorms to float a boat. So is fun for food.
Not everybody, I think, eats because they're lonely. I see that people do, you know, but not everybody does. But I think that one of the issues that I see is that when I talk to college students, they eat a lot of junk because it's cheap, you know. And I think that our food services in our colleges and universities has just gotten – I think they need to get back to, like, simpler, regular food,
Use the word vegetables. Jean, do not use the word vegetables. I saw you. Making a V with her mouth. Did you see that, Kelly?
Especially corn.
Yeah.
I just had to put it out there. I'm not really very fond of corn. But
but you have to admit it's good for you, right?
No.
Non-starchy plant-based foods.
Right.
It's actually a grain, you know. It's not, but it is.
You digress.
Yes.
But, you know, we we had a really good food service when I was in college, and we had really good, well-balanced meals that contained healthy sides. I'm not going to say the V word. I don't remember gaining 15 pounds when I was
a
freshman.
So let me ask you. This was Berea, right?
Uh-huh.
So they're the Berea football team. I don't know.
I don't think we had a football.
Right. So I think,
undefeated for.
Yes, I think we have a problem here because Kelly's going to UK. And what are you going to do? You're going to sit down with a nice bunch of vegetables and watch a UK football game?
No, you're not. But here's the thing. UK football games happen on the weekends. You're going to go. You can go to a football game and you can still eat a healthy breakfast. You can, you know, do what happens needs to do. Yeah, during the day. And maybe that day didn't go that well. But UK football doesn't happen every day. And I think that's the thing is people think you can enjoy a day or that you can't eat the food of tailgating because you're trying to be healthy. But if you're doing that on a Saturday for one meal, that's the difference between 7 days a week. Every meal.
So Kelly's advice, save that for special occasions. Do not create special occasions during weeknights just to sample pizza and other things.
Well, yeah, because like we just went and ate our meals. We didn't go out for pizza, so there really wasn't a place to go.
Okay? See, your life is every bit as sad as mine.
I know. Just in a different way.
So I'm sitting there lonely eating my, my mac and cheese.
But
you don't even have a football team, and your guys, you would just stay home and cook vegetables.
I just want to tell you that I have a degree from UK, too, and I never once went to a darn ball game.
I know.
Okay? I think that we're leaning too far toward those competitive sports. You know, you can be physically active and not be involved in competitive sports.
That's the Brie attitude. I understand that. Eastern has a football team.
Don't you think
they do?
You being a graduate student, probably don't even bother with Eastern football. Have you been to an Eastern football game?
I have not, yeah.
But you did go to UK football games when you were an undergrad.
I did, uh-huh.
Yeah.
It, you know.
And in the stadium at UK,
yes.
What type of vegetables were available to you?
You know, there weren't a lot. But, you know,
They had potatoes there.
They did have potatoes. Yeah, that's true.
They had potatoes. They were just cut and fried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you find yourself, though, I mean, for a lot of people, there are financial issues. You're right. It costs more, and the universities may not be doing that good a job. I don't have knowledge of this, so
They have fast food restaurants for their food service for the most part.
Of the above. They have buffets.
They have
cafeteria.
Everything. But you have a student who supposedly can't afford to buy fruits and vegetables, but can go to a UK football game and buy a $9 pretzel.
Oh.
You know, I mean, like, $9. You spend your money on what you want.
$4.50
maybe. But she used a very specific number. Nine is not a number you just pull out of your hat. You know, nine is, you know something about these pretzels. Or you would not use the $9 pretzels.
No, I mean, it's just not cheap. The point is, it's not cheap.
$9. That's how much it is.
It's only
$4.50. She had two.
Yeah, but are you just getting a pretzel?
I don't know. I don't go to UK football. And if I do, I'm in the press box.
Yeah, Rick's actually down in the press box trying to figure out which wire goes where. Up in the press box. No, you're down on the floor trying to figure out which wire goes to where.
I have people who help me with that.
You have people. I see. You have people. Never mind. Last article. I promise. I want to get to this because this is the type of science research
Kelly, what that
means wins
is
prizes.
Our opinion doesn't matter. Let's move on.
New York Times, September 5th. This was actually a summary of an article that published in the journal Science, which is a very reputable scientific journal. A guy named Jeffrey Gordon at Washington University in St. Louis did something that was amazing. We've talked a lot about the relationship between the germs in your colon and your health, whether you have inflammatory bowel disease, whether you have weight gain, all those sorts of things. The problem is we're having a difficult time in figuring out what germs do what. And so what they did was they bypassed that. They went around the world looking for twins in which only one twin is fat. That allowed them to cancel out genetics and environment. They had twins living in the same household. One of them was fat. One of them was not. They took the stool from the two twins. So they had a sample of the germs that were in the colon of the fat twin and the thin twin. They took that stool and they transplanted the stool into some mice that were genetically identical. And these mice didn't have any, they were raised sterile, they didn't have any germs in their colon. So the mice took on the germs from the identical twin, the fat twin or the thin twin's colon. And what they found was they fed them the exact same feed and the mice with the bacteria from the fat twins had 15 to 17% more body fat than from the thin twins. So same mice, genetically identical, same food, and when you give them the fat twins colonic bacteria, they gain more weight. You know, for a long time, I always heard that. This guy can eat anything and won't gain weight.
And won't gain weight, yeah.
And I just thought, you don't understand what this guy's doing. That's a bunch of baloney. There is then a mechanism whereby a person could gain more weight than another person on the exact same diet, and it involves the type of germs that are in your colon. Now, they put the fat mice and the thin mice in the same cage. Now, Rick, this is something that I know, having run an animal lab, and you need to know, mice eat each other's poop.
I could have went all day
without knowing that.
What this means is these mice actually shared germs then from each other's colons, and they found that with sharing germs and, again, giving them the same feed, the fat mice sometimes would lose weight as they picked up bacteria from the thin mice.
Well, what about the thin ones, though? Did they?
They would not gain.
Really?
Now, think about that for a minute, and it makes sense. The idea is you have a diverse group of bacteria in your colon if you eat healthy. If you do not eat healthy and you are overweight, you have less diversity. So what happens then is you're not going to kill the bacteria in a thin mouse's colon and overgrow it with less germs. But you could increase the number of germs in the fat mouse's colon and make it into a thin mouse.
Hmm.
Now, here's where it gets very interesting. His colleague, Vanessa Ridara, had an idea. She determined the diets of those who eat the most fruits and vegetables in the U.S. and the least saturated fats. And then she also looked at the diets of those at the opposite end of the spectrum, and they made mouse food to reflect the fattiest American diet and the healthiest American diet. They then fed that to the mice, regardless of their colonic bacteria, and they found that the fat mice that got food that was high in fat, low in fruits and vegetables, they kept their gut bacteria from the fat twins. They remained fat. The thin mice with the thin twins' gut bacteria, when they ate the bad diet, they, in fact, got fat as well. They lost their bacterial diversity. So what appears to be, you know, I think, first of all, the immediate solution here is, oh, we finally figured out fat. What we need to do is to transplant bacteria into your colon, and then you can continue. You know, it's the American solution.
Yeah, but see, what you got to do is you've got to feed it properly.
You have to feed your colon properly. If you do that, then your colon is going to protect you some from weight gain if you do it consistently. And as Kelly said, weekends, special occasions, okay. But if you, on a regular basis, eat the food that only a few bacteria like, you're going to wind up with only a few bacteria in your colon. You're going to absorb more from that food. If you can maintain that bacterial diversity, you've got a chance.
And so that's, it goes back to, are you ready for this, Rick? Eat your veggies.
Corn.
It's a grain.
Rick, this is really not going to end, is it?
Oh, yes, it is. Trust me on this one.
First of all, let's see if we can end this right now. I'd like to thank Jean Jones, manager of clinical nutrition services at St. Clair Regional, and also her dietetic intern, Kelly Jewell from Eastern Kentucky University. Rick?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hosoda and to Eric Bilry, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is an FDA-approved prescription radio show that may help some obese adults lose weight and keep the weight off.
Health Matters should be used together with a reduced-calorie diet and increased physical activity for chronic weight management in adults with an initial body mass index of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared.
Health Matters is a federally controlled radio show because it can be abused or lead to radio dependence.
The precise mechanism of action of the two co-hosts on chronic weight management is unknown.
It is not known if Health Matters changes your risk of heart problems or stroke, or of death due to heart problems or stroke.
It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective when taken with other prescription, over-the-counter, or herbal weight loss products.
It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective in children under 18 years of age.
If you take Health Matters during pregnancy, your baby has a higher risk for birth defects called cleft lip and cleft palate. These defects can begin early in pregnancy, even before you know you're pregnant.
Women who are pregnant must not listen to Health Matters.
Women who can become pregnant should have a negative pregnancy test every month while listening to Health Matters and use effective birth control consistently during the show.
Health Matters can increase your heart rate at rest. Your healthcare provider should check your heart rate while you listen to Health Matters. Tell your healthcare provider if you experience racing or pounding feelings in your chest lasting several minutes during the show.
Rick Phillips, a co-host of Health Matters, may cause you to have suicidal thoughts or actions.
Sometimes.
Call your healthcare provider right away if you have any symptoms, especially if they are new, worse, or worry you. attempts to commit suicide, being angry or violent, acting on dangerous impulses or other unusual changes in behavior or mood.
Serious eye problems, which include any sudden decrease in vision with or without eye pain and redness. These problems can lead to permanent vision loss if not treated. Tell your healthcare provider right away, if you have any new symptoms.
Whatever you do, do not take health matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.